in a pincer fashion, trying to surround the retreating German 10th Army before it could reform. Pinot and Liers went to high ground near Toracha, where they watched the town of Coriano and the heavy German defenses around it come under bombardment. More than 700 heavy shells were dropped on the town before ground forces attacked it. After 2 days of gruesome hand-to-hand combat, Coriano fell. In all, some 14,000 Allied soldiers and 16,000 Germans died in the area in a 2-week span. Despite the heavy casualties, German panzer and infantry divisions were able to retreat and reform along a new battle line to the north and northwest. The rest of Liers's Gothic line held. Even with the information Pinot was providing, the Allied advance in Italy again slowed to a crawl due to loss of men and supplies to France and the Western Front. Later in the month, machine workers in Milan went on strike. Some sabotaged their equipment as they left their factories. Tank production halted. General Liers spent days getting a tank assembly line restarted, only to hear in early October that Fiat's Mirafiore factory was about to go on strike. They went straight to Mirafiore, an outlying district of Turin. Pinot served as interpreter between the general and Fiat management in a room above the assembly line, which was running, but slowly. The tension in the room was thick. "I need more lorries," General Liers said. "More armored cars and more parts for machines in the field." Calabrese, the plant manager, was a fat, sweaty man in a business suit, but he was not afraid to stand up to Liers. "My people are not slaves, General," Calabrese said. "They work for a living. They should be paid for a living."
"They'll be paid," Liers said. "You have my word."
Calabrese smiled slowly, unconvincingly.
"If only it were that simple."
"Did I not help you with Factory 17? The general asked. "I had orders to take every piece of machinery there and ship it back to Germany."
"It doesn't matter now, does it? Factory 17 was destroyed in an Allied attack."
Liers shook his head at Calabrese.
"You know how this works. We scratch each other's backs. We survive."
"If you say so, General," Calabrese said.
Liers took a step closer to the Fiat manager, looked to Pinot, and said,
"Remind him that I have the power to force every man on that assembly line to enlist in the organization Tot or risk deportation to Germany."
Calabrese hardened and said,
"Slavery, you mean?"
Pinot hesitated, but translated.
"If necessary," Liers said. "It is your choice whether to leave this plant in your hands or in mine."
"I need some assurance beyond yours that will be paid."
"Do you understand my title? My job? I decide the number of tanks to be built. I decide the number of panties to be sewn.
You work for Albert Speer," the Fiat manager said. "You have his authority. Get him on the phone. Speer. If your boss can give me assurances, then we'll see."
"Speer? You think that weak ass is my boss?" the general said, looking insulted before asking to use the Fiat manager's telephone.
He was on it for several minutes, having several agitated arguments in German, before he bobbed his head and said,
"Jawohl, mein Führer."
7. Pinot's attention shot to the general, as did the attention of every man in the room, as Liers continued to speak into the phone in German. About 3 minutes into the conversation, he yanked the earpiece away from his head. The voice of Adolf Hitler in full rant came into the room. Liers looked at Pinot, smiled coldly, and said,
Tell Signor Calabrese that the Führer would like to give him his personal assurances of payment.
Calabrese looked like he'd rather have grabbed an electrical wire than the phone, but he took it and held the earpiece a few centimeters from his head. Hitler kept on in full oratorical rage, sounding like he was being ripped apart from the insides, probably foaming at the mouth as it was happening. Sweat poured off the Fiat manager's brow. His hands began to shake, and with them went his resolve. He shoved the phone back at Liers and said to Pino,
"Tell him to tell Herr Hitler that we accept his assurances."
"A wise choice," Liers said, and then returned the phone, saying in a soothing voice,
"Ja, mein Führer. Ja. Ja. Ja."
A few moments later, he hung up the phone. Calabrese collapsed in his chair, his suit drenched with sweat. As he set the phone down, General Liers looked at the manager and said,
"Do you understand who I am now?"
The Fiat manager would not look at Liers or reply. He barely managed a weak, submissive bob of his head.
"Very well, then," the general said. "I expect production reports twice weekly."
Liers handed the valise to Pino, and they left. It was nearly dark out, but still a nice, warm temperature.
"Dollies," the general said, climbing into the Daimler. "And no talking. I need to think."
"Oui, mon général," Pino said.
"Do you want the top up or down?"
"Leave it down," he said. "I like the fresh air."
Pino retrieved the burlap headlamp shields and mounted them before firing up the Daimler and heading east toward Milan, with two slits of light to show him the way. But within the hour, the moon rose huge and full in the eastern sky, throwing a mellow glow down on the landscape and making it easier for Pino to follow the route.
"That's a blue moon," Liers said. "The first of two full moons in 1 month. Or is it the second one? I can never remember."
It was the first time the general had spoken since leaving Turin.
"The moon looks yellow to me, mon général," Pino said.
"The term doesn't refer to the color, Vorarbeiter. Normally in a single season, in this case, autumn, there are 3 months and three full moons. But this year, tonight, right now, there's a fourth moon in the three-month cycle, two in 1 month. Astronomers call it a blue moon because it is such a rare occurrence."
"Oui, mon général," Pino said, driving a long, straight section of road and looking at the moon rising over the horizon like some omen.
When they came to a section of the road that was flanked on both sides by tall, well-spaced trees and fields beyond them, Pino was no longer thinking about the moon. He was thinking about Adolf Hitler. Had that actually been the Führer on the phone? He'd sure sounded crazy enough to be Hitler. And that question Liers had asked of the Fiat manager. "Do you know who I am now?" Pino stole a glance at the silhouette of Liers riding in the back seat and answered in his mind,
"I don't know who you are, but I sure know who you work for now."
He'd no sooner had that thought than behind them, to the west, he thought he caught the buzz of some larger engine. He looked in the rear view and side view mirrors, but saw no slit lights that would indicate an oncoming vehicle. The sound grew louder. Pino glanced again, seeing General Liers twisting around, and then something beyond him, something big back there above the trees. The moonlight caught the wings then, and the snout of the fighter, its engine a building roar and coming right at them. 8. Pino slammed on the Daimler's six brakes. They skidded, The fighter swooped over them like the shadow of a night bird before the pilot could trigger his machine guns and chew up the road out in front of the skidding staff car. The shooting stopped. The fighter gained altitude and banked to Pino's left and then was gone behind the treetops.
"Hold on, mon général!"
Pino cried and threw the vehicle in reverse. He backed up, swung the wheel right, shifted to low range and then first gear, punched off the headlights, and gunned it. The Daimler went down through the ditch, up the other side, and between a gap in the trees, into what looked like a recently plowed field. Pino pulled forward close to the base of a cluster of trees and stopped, clicked the ignition off.
"How did you—"
Liars began, sounding terrified.
"What are you—"
"Listen," Pino whispered. "He's coming back." The fighter bore down over the road the same way it had the first time, coming from the west, as if it meant to catch up with the staff car and destroy it from behind. Through the tree branches, Pino couldn't make it out for several seconds, but then the big silver bird blew by them and up the highway, silhouetted against the rarest of moons. Pino saw white circles with black centers on the fuselage and said, "He's British." "It's a Spitfire, then," Liars said, "with 303 Browning machine guns." Pino started the Daimler, waited, listening, peering. The fighter was making a tighter turn now, coming back above the near tree line 600 meters ahead of them. "He knows we're here somewhere," Pino said, and then realized the moon was probably glinting off the hood and windshield of the staff car. He threw the Daimler in gear, tried to bury the left front quarter panel in the thorn thicket growing up around the hedgerow, and stopped when the plane was 200 meters out. Pino ducked his head, felt the fighter go over them, and took off. The Daimler chewed up ground, gathering speed, mowing down clods and ruts the entire length of the plowed field. Pino kept looking back, wondering if the plane would make a third pass. Near the far corner of the field, he pulled into another gap in the trees, with the nose of the staff car facing down the bank into the road ditch. He turned off the engine a second time and listened. The plane was a distant, fading buzz. General Liar started laughing and then clapped Pino on the shoulder.
"You're a natural at the cat-and-mouse game," he said. "I would not have thought to do any of that, even without being shot at."
"Merci, mon général," Pino said, grinning as he started the Daimler and headed east again. Soon, however, he was conflicted. Part of him was appalled that he had basked once more in the general's praise. Then again, he had been smart and crafty, hadn't he? He'd certainly outwitted the British pilot, and he rather enjoyed that. 20 minutes later, they crested the hill with the full moon rising before them. Diving out of the night sky, the Spitfire crossed the face of the moon and flew right at them. Pino locked up the brakes. For a second time, the Daimler went into a six-wheel drive screeching skid.
"Run, mon général!"
Before the staff car had stopped, Pino leaped out the door, took one long off-balance stride, and dove for the ditch, even as the Spitfire's machine guns opened up and sent bullets skipping down the macadam. Pino landed in the ditch, felt the wind blow out of him as bullets struck steel and broke glass. Chunks of debris peppered his back, and he curled up, protecting his head and struggling for air. The shooting stopped then, and the Spitfire flew on to the west. Chapter 20 1. When the plane was a distant hum and he could breathe, Pino whispered in the darkness,
"Mon général?"
There was no reply.
"Mon général?"
No answer. Was he dead? Pino thought he'd be happy to think that, but instead he saw the downside. No more liars, no more spying. No more information for the... He heard a movement, and then a groan.
Mon général?
Yes,
Lyre said weakly.
Here.
He was behind Pino, struggling to sit up.
I must have blacked out. Last thing I remember, I was diving into the ditch, and...
What happened? Pino told the general as he helped him up the bank. The Daimler was backfiring, hesitating and shuddering, but somehow still running. Pino shut it off, and the engine mercifully died. He got the flashlight and toolkit from the trunk. He flicked the light on and passed its beam over the vehicle, with General Lyers gaping along with him. Bullets had ripped the Daimler from front to back, penetrating the hood, which was throwing steam. The machine gun had also blown out the windshield, perforated the front and back seats, and punched more holes through the trunk. The front right tire was flat. So was the opposite side's outer rear tire.
Can you hold this, mon général? Pino asked, holding out the torch.
Lyers looked at it blankly a moment, and then took it. Raising the hood, Pino saw that the engine block had been hit 5 times, but the light 303 rounds had not had enough energy left after piercing the hood to do any real damage. A spark plug cable was severed. Another looked ready to go. And there was a hole high in the radiator. But otherwise, the power plant, as Alberto Ascari liked to describe it, looked serviceable. Pino used a knife to strip and twist together the 2 pieces of the severed spark plug cable, and used first aid tape to bind it and the weaker cable. He got out the tire kit, found patches and rubber glue that he used to seal both sides of the radiator hole. Then he removed the flat front left tire and moved the outer right tire forward to replace it. He took off the flat outer back left tire and dumped it. When he started the Daimler, it still ran rough, but it was no longer bucking and coughing like an old smoker.
I think it will get us back to Milan, mon général, but beyond that, who knows?
Beyond Milan doesn't matter, Lyers said, sounding clearer-headed as he climbed into the back seat. The Daimler is too visible a target. We will change cars.
Oui, mon général, Pino said, and tried to put the staff car in gear.
It bucked and died. He tried again, gave it more petrol, and got it rolling. But running on 4 wheels instead of 6, the Daimler was no longer balanced, and they went shambling and shivering down the road. Second gear was gone. He had to rev the engine as high as he dared to get to third gear, but once they reached a decent speed, the vibrations calmed a bit. When they were 8 kilometers on, General Lyers asked for his flashlight, fumbled around in his valise, and came up with a bottle. He opened the top, took a gulp, and handed it over the seat.
Here, he said. Scotch whiskey. You deserve it. You saved my life.
Pino hadn't looked at it that way, and said,
I did what anyone would have done.
No, Lyers said in a scoff. Most men would have frozen and driven on into the machine guns and died. But you were not afraid. You kept your wits about you. You are what I used to call a young man of action.
I like to think so, mon général. Pino said, basking once more in Lyers's praise as he took the bottle and had a swig. The liquid spread hot through his belly.
Lyers took the bottle back.
That's enough for you until Milan.
The general chuckled. Over the vibrations in the Daimler, Pino heard Lyers take several more belts of the scotch straight off the bottle.
Lyers laughed sadly.
In some ways, Vorarbeiter Lella, you remind me of someone. 2 people, actually.
Oui, mon général, Pino said. Who are they?
The Nazi was quiet, took a sip, and then said,
My son and my nephew.
Pino hadn't expected that.
I did not know you had a son, mon général, Pino replied, and glanced in the mirror, seeing nothing but the suggestion of the man in the shadows of the back seat.
Hans Jürgen. He's almost 17. Smart. Resourceful. Like you.
Pino didn't know exactly how to react, so he said,
And your nephew?
There was a moment of silence before Liars sighed and then said,
Wilhelm, Willy, we called him, my sister's son. He served under Field Marshal Rommel, died at El Alamein.
He paused.
For some reason, his mother blames me for the loss of her only child.
Pino could hear the pain in Lyers's voice, and said,
I'm sorry to learn that, mon général. But your nephew served with Rommel, the Desert Fox.
Willy was a young man of action, the general agreed in a hoarse voice, before taking a drink. He was a leader who sought harm's way, and it cost him his life at 28, in the middle of a flea-infested Egyptian desert.
Did Willy drive a tank?
Liars cleared his throat and said,
With the 7th Panzers.
The Ghost Division. General Liars cocked his head.
How do you know of these things?
The BBC, Pino thought, but figured that would not go over well. So he said,
I read all the papers, and there was a newsreel at the cinema.
Reading newspapers, Liars said. A rare thing for someone so young. But both Hans Jürgen and Willy read all the time, especially the sports sections. We used to go watch sports together. Willy and I saw Jesse Owens run at the Berlin Olympic Games. Fantastic! How angry the Führer was that day when a black man bested our best. But Jesse Owens? Vorarbeiter, that Negro was a physical genius. Willy kept saying that, and he was right.
He fell off into silence, pondering, remembering, mourning.
Do you have other children? Pino asked at last.
A young daughter, Ingrid, he said with renewed brightness.
Where are they?
Hans Jürgen and Ingrid.
In Berlin, with my wife, Hanna-Lisa.
Pino nodded and focused on driving, while General Liars continued to drink the scotch at a slow but steady pace.
Dolly's a dear friend, Major General Liars announced sometime later.
I've known her a long time, Vorarbeiter. I like her a great deal. I owe her a great deal. I look out for her, and I always will. But a man like me doesn't leave his wife to marry a woman like Dolly. It would be like an old goat trying to cage a tigress in her prime.
He laughed with admiration and some bitterness before drinking again. Pino was shocked that Liars was opening up to him this way after 8 weeks of maintaining a cold reserve and with the difference in rank and age. But he wanted the general to keep talking. Who knew what he might let slip next? Liars fell into silence, sipping the booze once more.
Mon général, Pino said finally. May I ask you a question?
Liars's tongue sounded thick when he said,
What is it?
Pino slowed at an intersection, winced at the Daimler backfiring, and then glanced in the rear view before saying,
Do you really work for Adolf Hitler?
For what seemed like an eternity, Lyre said nothing. Then he replied in a slight slur,
"Many, many times, Vorarbeiter, I have sat at the left hand of the Führer. People say there is a bond between us, because both our fathers worked as customs inspectors. There is that. But I am a man who gets things done, a man to depend on. And Hitler respects that. He does. But..."
Pino glanced in the rear view and saw the general taking another draw on the scotch.
"But," Pino said.
"But it is a good thing I am in Italy. If you stay too close to someone like Hitler, you are going to burn some day. So I keep my distance. I do my work. I earn his respect and nothing more. Do you see?"
"Oui, mon général."
4 or 5 minutes passed before General Lyers took another swig and said,
"I am an engineer by training, Vorarbeiter. I have my doctorate. From the beginning, as a younger man, I worked for the government in armaments, awarding contracts. Millions upon millions of kronen. I learned how to negotiate with great men, industrialists like Flick and Krupp. And because of that, men like Flick and Krupp owe me favors."
Lyers paused and then said,
"I will give you some advice, Vorarbeiter. Advice that could change your life."
"Oui, mon général?"
"Doing favors," Lyers said. "They help wondrously over the course of a lifetime. When you have done men favors, when you look out for others so they can prosper, they owe you. With each favor, you become stronger, more supported. It is a law of nature."
"Yes," Pino said.
"Yes," Lyers said. "You can never go wrong in this way, because there will be times when you will need a favor, and it will be right there waiting to come to the rescue. This practice has saved me more than once."
"I will keep that in mind."
"You are a smart boy, just like Hans Jürgen," the general said, and laughed. "Such a simple, simple thing, the doing of favors, but because of them, I lived well before Hitler. I've lived well under Hitler, and I know I'll live well long after Hitler is gone."
Pino glanced at the mirror and saw Lyers's dark silhouette as he drained the scotch bottle.
"One last piece of advice from a man older than his years?"
"Oui, mon général?"
"You never want to be the absolute leader in the game of life, the man out front, the one everyone sees and looks to," Lyers said. "That's where my poor Willy made his mistake. He got out front, right there in the light. You see, Vorarbeiter, in the game of life, it is always preferable to be a man of the shadows, and even the darkness, if necessary. In this way, you run things, but you are never, ever seen. You are like a phantom of the opera. You are like..."
The scotch bottle fell to the floor. The general cursed softly. A moment later, with his arms wrapped around his valise, using it like a pillow, he began to chorfle, choke, snore, and fart. 2. When they reached Dolly's apartment building, it was almost midnight. Pino left the comatose general in the Daimler and left the staff car running for fear it might never start again. He ran through the lobby, past the crone's empty stool, and up the stairs to Dolly's. Anna did not answer until the third series of knocks. Dressed for bed in her nightgown and robe, Anna looked weary and lovely. "I need Dolly," he said. "What's happened?" Dolly said, coming down the hall in a black and gold dressing gown. "The general," Pino said. "He's had too
much to drink,"
General Lyers said, coming in through the open door, valise in hand.
"Nonsense, Vorarbeiter. I'm having another drink, and so are you. Will you join us, Dolly?"
Pino stared at Lyers, as if he were Lazarus arisen. As the general passed Pino, his breath was foul with alcohol, and his eyes looked like they were bleeding, but he wasn't slurring his words or weaving on his feet at all.
"What are we celebrating, Hans?"
Dolly said, brightening. Anna had said she was always up for a party.
"The blue moon," the general said, setting down the valise.
He kissed her lustily before throwing his arm around her shoulder and looking back at Pino.
"And we are celebrating the fact that Vorarbeiter Lella saved my life, and that deserves a drink."
He spun Dolly around the corner into the living area. Anna looked at Pino with a puzzled smile on her face.
"Did you?"
"I saved myself," Pino whispered. He kind of came along for the ride.
"Vorarbeiter!"
Lyers yelled from the other room.
"A drink! And fair Anna, too!"
When they entered the living room, the general was beaming and holding out generous tumblers of whiskey. Dolly was already gulping hers. Pino didn't know how Lyers was still standing, but the general took a draw of the liquor and launched into a blow-by-blow description of what he called the once-in-a-blue-moon duel between the sneaky pilot in the Spitfire and the daring Vorarbeiter in the Daimler. Dolly and Anna were on the edge of their seats as Lyers recounted the Spitfire's final return, and Pino's locking up the brakes and shouting at him to run, and the machine guns and the Daimler's near destruction. General Lyers raised his glass at the end of his story and said,
"To Vorarbeiter Lella, who I owe a favor or two."
Dolly and Anna clapped. Pino's face felt flushed from the attention, but he smiled and raised his glass in return. "Thank you, General." A loud rapping came at the door to the apartment. Anna set her glass down and went to the hallway. Pino went with her. When the maid opened the door, the old crone, the building concierge, was there in her ragged night clothes, holding a candle lantern.
"Your neighbors can't sleep for all the hell-raising," she scolded, blinking behind her glasses. "There's a lorry or something backfiring out in the street, and you're carrying on drunk in the middle of the night."
"I forgot," Pino said. "I'll go right down and turn the car off." Dolly and Lyers appeared at the end of the hallway.
"What is happening?"
Dolly asked. Anna explained, and Dolly said,
"We're all going to bed now, Signora Plastino. Sorry to have kept you up."
The crone made a harumphing noise, and, still indignant, turned away, holding the candle lantern high, dragging the filthy hem of her nightgown behind her, and groping her way down the staircase. Pino followed her at a safe distance. After he turned off the staff car's engine, and after a very drunk General Lyers and Dolly had retired to their bedroom, he was at last alone again with Anna in the kitchen. She warmed up a sausage, broccoli, and garlic dish, and poured him a glass of wine and one for herself. Then she sat opposite him, chin in her hand, and asked him questions about the fighter plane and what it felt like to be shot at, to have someone trying to kill him. "It felt scary," he said, after thinking about it for a moment between bites of the delicious meal. "But I was more scared afterward, when I'd had a chance to think about it. Everything was happening so fast, you know?"
"No,
and I don't want to know, not really. I don't like guns.
Why?
They kill people, and I'm a people.
Lots of things kill people. Are you frightened of mountain climbing?
Yes, she said. Aren't you?
No, Pino said, drinking his wine. I love mountain climbing and skiing.
And dueling with airplanes?
When it's called for, he said, and grinned. This is fantastic, by the way. You really are a great cook.
Old family recipe, and thank you, Anna said, rolling her shoulders forward and studying his face. You're full of surprises, you know.
Am I? Pino asked, pushing the plate back.
I think people underestimate you.
Good.
I'm serious. I underestimated you.
Did you?
Yes. I'm proud of you, that's all.
That made him flush.
Thanks.
Anna continued to gaze at him for several long moments, and he felt himself falling into her eyes, as if they created a world unto themselves.
I don't think I've ever met anyone quite like you, she said at last.
I should hope not. I mean, that's a good thing, yes? Anna sat back.
Good and frightening all at the same time, if I'm being honest.
I scare you? He said, frowning.
Well, yes, in a way.
What way?
She looked off, shrugged. You make me wish I were different. Better. Younger, anyway.
I like you just the way you are. Anna gazed at him doubtfully. Pino reached out to her. Anna looked at his hand a long moment, and then smiled and took it in hers.
You're special, Pino said.
For a fantasy, I mean. Anna's smile widened, and she got up and came over to sit in his lap.
Show me I'm special for real, she said, and kissed him.
When they broke apart, they touched foreheads and entwined their hands. Pino said,
You know secrets that could get me killed, but I know so little about you.
After several moments, Anna seemed to come to some kind of decision and touched her uniform above her heart.
I'll tell you about one of my scars, an old one.
Anna said her early childhood was magical. Her father, a commercial fisherman and native of Trieste, owned his own boat. Her mother was from Sicily, superstitious about everything, but a good mother, a loving mother. They had a nice home near the marina and good food on the table. Due to a series of miscarriages, Anna was an only child and doted on by her parents. She loved being in the kitchen with her mother. She loved being on the boat with her father, especially on her birthday.
Papa and I would go out on the Adriatic before dawn, Anna said. We'd go west in the darkness several kilometers. Then he'd turn the boat around east and let me take the wheel. I'd drive the boat straight into the sunrise. I loved that.
How old were you?
Oh, maybe 5 the first time.
On her 9th birthday, Anna and her father got up early. It was raining and windy, so there would be no voyage into the sunrise, but she wanted to go anyway.
So we did, she said,
fell quiet, and then cleared her throat. The storm got worse, a lot worse. My father put a life preserver on me. We were getting hit by waves, and we got turned broadside to them. A big one hit us hard enough to capsize the boat and throw us into the sea. I was rescued later in the day by other fishermen from Trieste.
my father was never found.
Oh, God, Pino said. That's horrible.
Anna nodded, tears slipping from her eyes and dripping on his chest.
My mother was worse, but she's a scar for another time. I have to sleep, and you have to go.
Again? Yes, she said, smiled, and kissed him once more. Though he desperately wanted to stay, Pino felt happy upon leaving Dolly's apartment around 2 o'clock a.m. He hated seeing Anna's face disappear as she closed the door, but he loved that she looked forward to seeing him again. Downstairs, the lobby and the old crone's stool were empty. He went outside and looked at the bullet holes in the Daimler and wondered how they'd survived. He would go home and sleep, and in the morning he would find his uncle. He had much to tell. 3. The next morning, while Aunt Greta cut and toasted bread she'd stood hours in a ration line to buy, Uncle Albert took notes as Pino recounted all that had happened to him since they'd last spoken. He finished with the story of General Lyers getting drunk. Uncle Albert sat there several moments and then asked,
"How many lorries and armored cars did you say are coming off the Fiat lines every day?"
70, Pino said. "If it weren't for the sabotage, they'd be making more."
"That's good to know," he said, scribbling.
Aunt Greta put toast, butter, and a small jar of jam on the table.
"Butter and jam?" Uncle Albert said. "Wherever did you get that?"
"Everyone has their secrets," she said, and smiled.
"Even General Lyers, it seems," Uncle Albert said.
"Especially General Lyers," Pino said. "Did you know he reports directly to Hitler? That he sat at the Führer's left hand in meetings?" His uncle shook his head.
"Lyers is far more powerful than we thought, which is why I'd love to see what he's got in that valise."
"But he's always got it with him, or where it would be noticed missing."
"He leaves clues, though. He spent the better part of a week dealing with strikes and sabotages, which says to me strikes and sabotage are working, which says we need more sabotage in the factories. We'll break the Nazis gear tooth by gear tooth."
"The Germans are also having trouble paying," Pino said. "Fiat is working on Hitler's guarantee of payment, not cash." Uncle Albert studied Pino, thought about that.
"Scarcity," he said at last.
"What?" Aunt Greta said.
"The food lines are getting worse, aren't they?"
She nodded.
"Longer every day, for nearly everything."
"It's going to get much worse," her husband said. "If the Nazis have no money to pay, their economy is starting to break down. They will start seizing more and more of our stores soon, and that will lead to more scarcity and more misery for everyone in Milan."
"You think so?"
Aunt Greta said, worrying her apron.
"It's not necessarily a bad thing, scarcity, in the long run, I mean. More misery, more pain, will mean more of us willing to fight until the last German is dead or driven from Italy."
4. By the middle of October 1944, events were starting to prove Uncle Albert right. Pino drove General Lyers's new staff car, a Fiat four-door sedan, southeast from Milan one beautiful autumn morning. It was harvest time on the Po River Valley floor. Men were taking scythes to grain and picking gardens, groves, and orchards. Lyers sat in the back of the Fiat, as was his custom, the valise open, reports in his lap. Since they'd survived the strafing, Lyers had been more cordial to Pino, but he showed little of the empathy and openness he had that night. Then again, Pino hadn't seen him take a drink since. He followed the general's directions, and within an hour they arrived at a large meadow in the countryside. 50 German lorries were parked there, along with panzer tanks, armored cars, and 700 or 800 soldiers, a full battalion of them. Most were Organization Tot men, but they had a full company of SS soldiers behind them. General Liers exited the car, his face hard. At the sight of the general, the entire battalion came to attention. Liers was met by a lieutenant colonel, who led him to a stack of weapons crates. Liers climbed up on the crates and began to speak rapidly and forcefully in German. Pino was only catching the odd phrase or word, something about the fatherland and the needs of brother Germans, but whatever he was saying certainly revved up the troops. They were upright, shoulders back, mesmerized by the general as he exhorted them. General Liers finished his speech, shouting something about Hitler, and then threw his arm up and out in the Nazi salute.
"Sieg Heil!" he roared. "Sieg Heil!"
they thundered back at him. Pino stood there, confused by the fear he felt growing inside him. What had Liers said to them? What was happening? The general disappeared with several officers into a tent. The 800 soldiers climbed into half the lorries and left the others empty. Their diesel engines rattled to life. The vehicles began to snake their way out of the meadow, one lorry full of men followed by an empty one. Some pairs went north on the rural road, and the rest headed south, lumbering into the distance like so many war elephants on parade. Liers emerged from the tent. His face betrayed nothing as he climbed into the back seat of the Fiat and told Pino to drive south through the Po River Valley, as fertile a place as there was on earth. 3 kilometers into the drive, Pino saw a girl sitting in the driveway of a small farm with a grain tower. She was sobbing. Her mother sat on the front stoop, her face in her hands. Not far down the road, Pino saw the body of a man face down in the ditch, with his white t-shirt bruised purple from drying blood. Pino glanced in the rear view. If Liers had seen any of it, he wasn't showing a reaction. His head was down. He was reading. The road ran down through a creek bottom and came up onto a large flat with harvested fields on both sides. Less than a kilometer ahead, a small settlement of houses was clustered next to a large grain bin made of stone. German lorries were parked on the road and in the farmyards. Platoons of Waffen-SS soldiers marched people out into their front yards, maybe 25 of them, and forced them to their knees with fingers laced behind their heads.
"Mon général," Pino said.
In the back seat, Liers looked up, cursed, and told him to stop. The general climbed out and shouted at the SS men. The first Tot soldier appeared with large grain sacks on his shoulders. Others came behind, 20, maybe more, laden with grain sacks. The SS reacted to something Liers said, and the families were urged to their feet and then allowed to sit as a group while they watched their grain, their livelihood, their survival, stolen and thrown into the back of a Nazi transport. One of the farmers would not sit and started shouting at Liers.
"You can at least leave us enough to eat. It's the decent thing to do."
Before the general could reply, one of the SS soldiers hit the farmer in the head with the butt of his rifle and dropped him in his tracks.
"What did he say to me?" Liers asked Pino.
Pino told him. The general listened, thought, and then called to one of his Tot officers,
"Nehmen Sie alles!"
Then he headed toward the car. Pino followed, upset, because he knew enough German to understand Liers' command. "Nehmen Sie alles. Take everything." Pino wanted to kill the general, but he couldn't. He had to swallow his anger and marshal himself. But did Lyris have to take everything? As he slid into the Fiat, Pino silently repeated a vow he'd made to remember what he'd seen, from the slaving to the pillaging. When the war was over, he would tell the Allies everything. They drove on into the early afternoon, seeing more and more farms with Germans under Lyris's command stealing grain bound for mills, vegetables bound for market, and livestock bound for slaughter. Cows were shot in the head, gutted, and thrown into the lorries whole, their carcasses throwing steam into the cool air. Every once in a while, the general would tell Pino to stop, and he'd climb out to have a conversation with a Tote officer or two. Then he'd order Pino to drive on and return to his reports. Pino kept glancing in the mirror, thinking how Lyris seemed to shift and change with every moment. How can he possibly be unmoved by what we've seen? How can he...
You think I'm a wicked man, Vorarbeiter?
Lyris said from the back seat. Pino looked in the mirror, saw the general looking back at him.
No, mon général, Pino said, trying to put on his happy face.
Yes, you do, Lyris said. It would be surprising if you didn't hate me for what I've had to do today. A part of me hates myself. But I have orders. Winter is coming. My country is under siege. Without this food, my people will starve. So here in Italy, and in your eyes, I'm a criminal. Back home, I'll be an unsung hero. Good, evil. It's all a question of perspective, is it not?
Pino gazed at the general in the mirror, thinking that Lyris seemed infinite and ruthless, the kind of man who could justify almost any action in pursuit of a goal.
Oui, mon général, Pino said, and couldn't restrain himself. But now my people will starve.
Some might, Lyris said. But I answer to a greater authority. Any lack of enthusiasm for this mission on my part could be grounds for... Well, that's not going to happen if I can help it. Take me back to Milan, the central train station.
Chapter 21 1. Lorries stacked high with Nazi booty from Italian farms, orchards, and vineyards jammed into the streets around the train depot. Pino followed General Lyris into the station and out to the loading platforms, where German soldiers were loading grain sacks, wine kegs, and full bushel baskets of fruits and vegetables into boxcar after boxcar. Lyris seemed to understand the whole system, firing questions at subordinates and calling out notes to Pino as he marched up and down the platforms.
9 trains travel north through the Brenner tonight, the general said at one point. Arrival Innsbruck at 0700 hours. Arrive Munich 1300 hours. Arrive Berlin 1700 hours. In total, 360 cars of food will...
Lyris stopped dictating. Pino looked up. 7 Waffen-SS soldiers blocked their way. Beyond them, a string of 7 rickety old cattle cars sat on the track by the far platform. At some point, the cars must have been a barn red color, but the paint had blistered and peeled, and the wood was splintered and cracked, making them look barely fit for travel. Lyris said something threatening to the SS soldiers, and they stood aside. The general walked toward the train of old boxcars. Pino followed. Looking up, he saw the sign marked Binario 21. He was puzzled, knowing he'd heard of it before, but not placing it. With all the din inside the station from the loading of loot, It wasn't until Pino was beside the last car that he heard children crying inside. The sound seemed to freeze the general. Liars stood there, staring at the cracked and splintering walls of the cattle car, and the many desperate eyes staring back through the cracks at him and at Pino, who now remembered Mrs. Napolitano saying that Platform 21 was where Jews disappeared on trains heading north.
"Please,"
a woman inside the cattle car sobbed in Italian.
"Where are you taking us? After the prison, you can't leave us in here like this. There's no room. There's..."
Lyris looked at Pino with a stricken expression.
"What is she saying?"
Pino told him. Sweat broke out on the general's forehead.
"Tell her she's going to an organization tot work camp in Poland. It's..."
The locomotive engine sighed. The train rolled back a foot. That set off wailing inside the boxcars, hundreds of men, women, and children screaming to be let out, demanding to know their destination and begging for any small mercy.
"You're going to a work camp in Poland," Pino told the crying woman. "Pray for us," she said,
before the wheels squealed on the tracks and the train began to pull away from Binario 21. Three little fingers stuck out of a crack on the rear wall of the last cattle car. The fingers seemed to wave at Pino as the train gathered speed. He stared after the train, seeing the fingers in his mind long after he couldn't see them anymore. His urge was to go after the train and set those people free, get them to safety. Instead, he stood there, defeated, helpless, and fighting the urge to cry at the image of those fingers, which would not fade.
"General Lyas!"
Pino turned. So did the general, who was pale. Had he seen those fingers, too? Beyond them, down the platform, Gestapo Colonel Walter Ralph was chugging toward them, his face flushed with anger.
"Colonel Ralph," Lyas said.
Pino took a step away from the general and studied the platform beneath his feet. He didn't want Ralph to recognize him, for fear that he might become suspicious of the Italian boy from Casa Alpina somehow becoming the driver to General Lyers. The Gestapo colonel started yelling at Lyers, who began yelling right back at him. Pino understood little of it, but he did hear Ralph invoke Joseph Goebbels's name. Lyers responded by invoking Adolf Hitler. And in their body language, Pino got the meaning. Ralph answered to Goebbels, a Reich minister. But Lyers answered to the Führer himself. After several minutes of intense threats and ice-cold conversation, a furious Ralph stepped back and saluted.
"Heil Hitler!"
Lyers returned the salute with less enthusiasm. Ralph was about to leave when he fixed on Pino for several seconds. Pino could feel his attention dancing all over him.
"Vorarbeiter," General Lyers called. "We are leaving. Bring the car around."
"Jawohl, General,"
Pino said in his best German, and then hurried past the two Nazi officers, never once looking at Ralph, but feeling his flat, dark eyes fixed on him. With every step, Pino expected to be called back. But Ralph never said a word, and Pino left Platform 21, praying he'd never have to return. 2. General Lyers climbed into the staff car with his normal, unreadable expression back in place.
"Dollies," he said.
Pino glanced in the rear view and saw Lyris's eyes screwed toward the horizon. He knew he should keep his mouth shut, but he couldn't.
"Mon général?"
"What is it, Vorarbeiter?"
he asked, still looking out the window.
"Are the people in the boxcars really going to an OT work camp in Poland?"
"Yes," the general said.
It's called Auschwitz.
Why Poland? At that, Lyris's eyes came unscrewed, and he almost shouted in irritation.
Why all the questions, Vorarbeiter?